Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The Harper government could decide next week if it wants to send CF-18 fighter jets to help in the coalition airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq. McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru weighs in on Canada's future role, and we speak with former British MP David Miliband, who is now the head of the International Rescue Committee.
The Prime Minister and European leaders sign off on the final agreement of the Canada-EU trade deal, although there are questions about whether it will be ratified by the European nations involved. We speak with veteran trade negotiator and author Derek Burney about how this deal is opening up opportunities for Canada.
Democracy in action or contempt of Parliament? The parliamentary secretary to the Prime Minister creates a controversy in the House of Commons when he answers questions on Iraq with attacks on the NDP over Israel. He has since made a tearful apology. The McLean's panel weighs in on what happened.
An outgoing Liberal MP Ted Hsu talks about the personal burdens of being a member of Parliament. We speak with the newly elected Premier of New Brunswick, and we bring you Question Period in review.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Will Canada soon be joining coalition airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq and Syria? According to the CBC, next week, Cabinet will meet to discuss the option of sending a fleet of CF-18s to help in the battle against the terrorist group. Prime Minister Stephen Harper hasn't confirmed this yet, but makes it clear Canada will not sit idly by while ISIS continues its horrific violence in the Middle East.
When we recognize there is a threat like this that has to be done, and it involves our own interests, we do our part. We do not stand on the sidelines and watch. We do our part. That's always been how this country has handled its international responsibilities. And as long as I'm Prime Minister, that's what we will continue to do.
News of this expanded role first broke when the Prime Minister was taking part in a Q&A session with a business crowd in New York ahead of the United Nations meeting. He was asked about Canada's mission in Iraq.
Would you rule out a direct military contribution to any effort?
No, we haven't ruled out anything. Say we need to have some additional debate within our government before we reach a final decision. But we're wanting to see this be successful, and we want to be supportive as best we can.
Has the United States formally asked you to contribute?
The United States just recently, in the last couple of days, has asked for some additional contribution. And we're weighing our response to that.
There were reports that Canada had originally offered the additional help and not the other way around. That led to claims from the opposition that the Prime Minister had misled Canadians. But the reports were quickly dismissed by the Prime Minister and the American ambassador to Canada, Bruce Hayman, who says it is Washington that's asking Canada to expand its role in the Middle East.
So what does this mean for our country, and where does the conflict go from here? McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes sits down with our foreign correspondent Michael Petru, who's been keeping an eye on the situation on the front lines in this battle with ISIS.
Mike, good to talk about this. I know you follow this stuff closer than just about anybody I know. There is, reportedly at least, Canada is thinking about doing airstrikes in this conflict in Iraq, northern Iraq. What do you think about that? Where does that position us with respect to the sort of other Western powers that evolved? And what's the importance of that?
Well, that would put us alongside some of our major allies. The United States and France have already launched airstrikes. Britain today voted to approve air action against Islamic State. Australia is weighing that option. So it would put us side by side with some of our closest allies. There are, of course, many countries that have not yet taken place, but several Arab countries that took part in the initial American sorties against Syria. So it puts us as part of a broader coalition of some of our closest Western allies, but also some Arab partners that have seen the threat of the Islamic State as well.
Starts to sound a little bit like Libya almost to me, where we have an airstrike campaign that is, seems effective, but doesn't seem all that risky to the populations back home. Is that how it looks to you?
I think that's probably fair, because of course no one is willing no one has publicly said or is comfortable at least with the idea of putting ground troops in Iraq, or certainly not in Syria. So I think most analysts would say that the airstrikes may degrade ISIS or Islamic State, but there really remains the large problem of who on the ground would fill the spaces vacated by Islamic State. And that requires, in order to seriously push them out or keep them out, that requires some semblance of coherent government and security on the ground. And in both countries, that is hard to come by. Certainly in Syria, it's very much an open question as to who would fill Islamic State's spot on the ground if they are, in fact, sufficiently degraded. And even in Iraq, beyond the Kurdish areas, the Iraqi army has had a very difficult time imposing control in the kind of Sunni triangle or the Sunni areas north and west of Baghdad. So I think the airstrikes are kind of a counter-terrorism tactic. They will punish Islamic State, they will degrade them, they will hopefully keep them off balance. But it really, I think it's hard to imagine that airstrikes on their own comprehensively and irrevocably keeping Islamic State out of these areas.
Geez, I wasn't thinking about this parallel before, but that sounds a bit like Libya too, the idea that airstrikes are, you know, kind of effective as far as they go, satisfying for people who would like to have a direct impact, but maybe ultimately can't create order where there's chaos.
I think that's the case. And again, I mean, the hope is that the, you know, moderate Syrian rebels who are opposed to both Bashar al-Assad and Islamic State will play that role on the ground in Syria, and that the Kurdish Peshmerga and the Iraqi military will play that role in Iraq. But I mean, even, and Western leaders have discussed this mission as being one that'll take years, not months. So I think this is not a military mission that'll have a neat or a quick ending.
Mike, just a point about domestic politics on this. I mean, I know you've been looking at the question about parliamentary oversight of the Canadian military. Where do we think we stand on that? I think the government signaled that airstrikes would be a combat mission and therefore would be subject to some kind of vote in the House.
Yes, our Foreign Affairs Minister, John Baird, has made that explicit, that airstrikes would constitute a combat mission and therefore would be taken to the House. It's an interesting phenomenon. Legally, of course, there is no requirement for Parliament to be consulted if our military is deployed abroad. Parliament was consulted when we declared war on Germany in the Second World War, but not for some of the other Axis powers, and indeed for the following 60 years, it was rarely used. This is the prerogative of the Crown acting on the advice of the political executive. It's something that Stephen Harper has revived and has become almost a political rule now, if not a legal one. He's established a precedent in Afghanistan, for example, that, as he phrases it, and there's been some gray areas here, but that combat missions will require the approval of the House. So again, there remains no legal imperative for this in Canada. But having established this precedent and having mentioned it, kind of as a point of a policy.
Makes it a political fact rather than a constitutional rule, right?
Exactly. I mean, he has that constitutional right to deploy troops, to go to war without the approval of the House. But again, the precedent that he's set and his own statements make that a very difficult thing to do now. So he's not legally required, but I think if we, and they've been clear about this, that if we do move into an explicitly combat mission in Iraq, Parliament will be consulted.
Mike, I'll let you go in a minute, but I know you've covered lots of combat zones. You've been to cover wars for us. People are talking about this as a crisis, which always to me sounds like people are thinking about it as having a short fuse, you know, like that we're in something that, well, you know, we're in a crisis moment right now. But isn't this likely going to look more like a long-term strategic struggle rather than a brief pot-burning crisis? I mean, won't we still be talking about this probably 5 or 10 years from now?
Well, hopefully not regarding Islamic State specifically. I mean, they fit into this broader sectarian conflict, which is really tearing apart a lot of the Middle East between Sunnis and Shias, for example. But I mean, I have to be clear here that they're rejected by the vast majority of Sunni Muslims as well, and indeed, the states that have joined the United States bombing them in Syria are predominantly Sunni as well. So I mean, they do fit into this broader struggle, and that struggle, I think, and spin off clashes as a result of that struggle, I think, unfortunately, will go on for a long time. I'm a little bit more optimistic about the fate of Islamic State. I think they are so vile, and I think are seen that way by such a broad spectrum of people that I don't think they are long for this world. Certainly, as a power that has a quasi state. I mean, I think those days are numbered. I mean, that said, as we discussed earlier on, given the lack of ground troops, given the weakness of governing institutions in Iraq, given the civil war in Syria, I think it is reasonable to be worried and to perhaps accept and steel ourselves for the possibility that Islamic State in some form will persist for again, possibly for years.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with our foreign correspondent Michael Petru. You're listening to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine. Keeping with the topic of the battle against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, the International Rescue Committee is one of the many aid organizations trying to help those in the war-ravaged region. McLean's political editor Paul Wells speaks with former British MP David Miliband, who is now head of the IRC.
It seems to me that even as recently as a decade ago, when the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were young, we could still kid ourselves that these were traditional sort of state-to-state industrial confrontations. And that pretense has just gone out the window. You had two different classes of targets struck by the United States in Syria and a Syrian fighter jet hit by Israel. And it's just a hell of a mess. Which way is up in a world like that?
Well, I think that after 9/11, if we'd been having this conversation, we'd have said this is an asymmetric world. It's a world where a non-state actor can strike at the heart of the strongest country in the world. And I think that notion of an asymmetric world holds good today, I mean, or holds bad today. And I think that that's the notion, and states have to deal with non-state actors, but they also have to deal with other states that who are leveraging their power in profound ways, and small countries can have big impacts.
It seems to me that the Obama administration has tried hard to bring a diversity of replies to this diversity of threats. But sometimes the president can seem simply not to be leading. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
I mean, it's not for me to provide political commentary. And, you know, I can't be sucked down that hole. The truth is that America is the most powerful country in the world. Its decisions provide the benchmark for others. But obviously it's a very different shaped world. And there are other countries now that have the power generally to stop things. It's harder for America to get what it wants in the world. And that's why people talk about it being a multipolar world. And obviously their fear is that it's an apolar world. It's a world without leadership. And I think that it's very important that at a time when citizens are feeling the pinch economically, there's always a temptation to turn inward. And I think it's very important that countries that have been the authors of globalization, which are those in the West, remain globally engaged.
Is the International Crisis Group able to get aid and material help delivered in the Syrian theater? Is it simply impossible to get that?
We are able to deliver healthcare inside Syria, cross border work, but obviously it's extremely challenging in a war when civilians are used as targets and when aid workers are also targeted. It's very, very hard. But we currently have big operations in the region, helping refugees in Jordan, Turkey, Iraq. But we're also doing significant amount of cross-border work to try to help people survive in the most challenging circumstances.
And are the challenges increasing or decreasing?
I think that they're undoubtedly increasing. I mean, the challenge for humanitarian effort is growing, partly because the crises are growing. I mean, we're acting not just in Syria, but we're in South Sudan, where there's a famine, and in Sierra Leone, where there's an Ebola outbreak. So there's, first of all, the multiplicity of challenges. Secondly, there's the complexity of challenges. Now we're dealing with urban refugees, not just camp. We are having to deal in a wider range of cultural contexts. And then thirdly, it's more difficult because the security situation is so dangerous, not especially because humanitarians are targeted per se, but because we're in areas where respect for civilian life, for the role of a non-combatant, is being eroded. And the terrible tragedy of the Syria conflict is that when it comes to dropping barrel bombs on Syrian cities, no one is considered to be a non-combatant. Everyone is treated as fair game, and that is a huge retreat from the norms that have been established since 1945, and that's why I talk about the Syria war being a war without law, not just a war that seems to be at end.
That was McLean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with David Miliband, the head of the International Rescue Committee.
Still to come, Canada signs a free trade deal with the European Union. The parliamentary secretary to the Prime Minister apologizes after a bizarre exchange in the House of Commons. And we talk with an MP about why he's leaving politics after only one term. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, the Parliamentary Secretary to the Prime Minister apologizes in the House of Commons. We take a look at why a one-term MP has decided to leave politics, and we hear from the man who is about to become the Premier of New Brunswick. But first,
European Union leaders were in Ottawa on Friday for a summit with Prime Minister Stephen Harper to mark the end of 5 long years of negotiating a new trade deal.
By giving Canadian exporters preferential access to the EU's 500 million affluent customers, this agreement will reshape our commercial relationship with the world's single largest marketplace. Upon implementation, the elimination of almost all tariffs is expected to generate a massive increase in business and thousands of new jobs. On its own, therefore, it is a game changer.
The comprehensive agreement still has to be approved by the EU's Council and Parliament and 28 member states. That ratification is not guaranteed. It should be a tight vote with opposition from countries like Germany, Italy, France, and Austria.
For a perspective on what this landmark agreement could mean, we went to Derek Burney, one of the architects of the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement. Burney is co-author with Carleton University professor Fenn Hampson of Brave New Canada. He spoke with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, explaining this trade deal and others like it are opening up new opportunities for Canada and the provinces.
We talk about interprovincial free trade, but you know the premiers have talked about it forever, but they haven't done anything. This agreement actually obliges them to do things. And to me, that's the only way we're going to get the provinces to move more towards interprovincial free trade is through international agreements where they are involved in the process. So yeah, it's a significant achievement. The only caveats I would offer are these are not growing economies. The European economies, if anything, even Germany is going in reverse right now. So while the ingredients of the agreement break new ground, we, Fenn and I, don't see this as offering the economic promise that we think there is in markets that are have a stronger prospect of growth. And we say that for a couple of reasons. Not only, you know, partly demographic. If you look at the economies of Asia, these are younger populations, by and large, rapidly urbanizing populations, by and large. That's where the growth is going to be, and that's where the demand for what Canada has the most of is going to be, in our view. That's why, in terms of magnitude, the Korea deal is smaller, but it's more significant because it's getting us into a growth market. And we should be able to supplement it with an agreement with Japan, hopefully with India, something with China. I mean, we address China pretty bluntly, and I think, in the book, saying that the government's blown hot and cold on China.
With the new prime minister in India, you have to think that India is just a fascinating story right now as a potential. If we could get a trade deal with India at a time that India may be liberalizing its economy domestically, it'd be a fascinating thing.
Well, and we have to think in terms of leverage. If you're negotiating with China and with India, one can help the other. Mm. You know,
yeah.
That's what strategy. That's what a cohesive strategy throws off. Yes, one negotiation is important, but always keep in mind what else it will do. I would think that the agreement with Korea will help us with Japan, will help us with China, help us with India, because all of these economies are swirling around. Everybody's trying to find a new platform for engagement.
That was veteran trade negotiator Derek Burney speaking with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Earlier this week, there was a bizarre exchange in the House of Commons that led to a more broad debate about how question period is being run. NDP leader Thomas Mulcair wanted details about the Canadian military mission in Iraq. But when Paul Calandra, the parliamentary secretary to the prime minister, got up to speak, he would only talk about Israel. Here's an edited version of that back and forth.
Will the Conservative government confirm that the 30-day Canadian commitment in Iraq will indeed end on October 4th?
Well, Mr. Speaker, there's a great deal of confusion with respect to the NDP position on Israel.
Well, I can understand the confusion. We are in the Middle East, and we are under the eyes, but we're talking about Iraq.
What does the leader of the opposition not understand that our friends in Israel are on the front lines combating terrorism, Mr. Speaker? We'll stand up for peace and security around the world, and unlike them, we're not confused by our position.
Mr. Speaker, there are rules in the book about question period. You are our arbiter. We ask you to enforce the rules on relevance and on question period.
Clearly, the leader of the NDP does not identify or understand the fact that our friends in Israel are on the front lines combating terrorism in the region, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Well, Mr. Speaker, that does not speak very favourably about your neutrality in this House.
For that line, Mulcair lost a couple of his questions in the House. But his decision to challenge the Speaker brought a lot of media attention to the non-answers. And by Friday, Paul Calandra, with tears in his eyes, made an emotional apology.
I would like to unconditionally, unreservedly apologize to this House for... my behavior the other day. Clearly, I allowed the passion and the anger of which something I read to get in the way of appropriately answering a question to the Leader of the Opposition. For that, I apologize to you and to this entire House and to my constituents. I can say this, that despite what people think about kids in short pants, this was my response, and I take full responsibility.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Aaron Wherry, the Associate Editor for Maclean's, as well as the Political Editor, Paul Wells. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi.
So, we're talking about this issue with Calandra. What really happened here?
The Conservatives decided, while they were still in opposition, the question period was not for getting information from the government. That if you are the government, the much safer thing to do is to stonewall. And... the stonewalling is all the more the only possible option when you're a guy like Paul Calandra, who has no ministerial responsibilities, is not properly briefed on the actual content of the files. Paul Calandra didn't have the faintest clue when the Iraq mission began or ended, and it was unfair to ask him. And so he made something up, and it was ridiculous. But that's also part of the standard operating procedure of this government. Pierre Poilievre, when he was the Prime Minister's... parliamentary secretary, he spent a year responding to every question from one NDP MP by saying that that NDP MP was a separatist. Didn't matter what the guy was talking about. That was Poilievre's answer. Suddenly, Poilievre's in cabinet. So if you're Paul Calandra, why would you not imitate that? And then it just went badly. It was a little too ridiculous. It was a little bit too off topic. And crucially, Tom Mulcair decided that on this day, he was going to be tougher than the government in his response. Tom Mulcair was going to do something more outrageous and more controversial by challenging the Speaker. And that put what Calandra had said on the map rather than letting him off the hook.
So in this scenario, was this just a sign of the sad reality of question period nowadays, or was this a unique situation of blatant disrespect to the House of Commons?
I think it was a bit of both. I think there's a difference between what happens in question period every day and normal evasion and normal nonsense. You know, there's a difference between what Pierre Poilievre did and what Paul Calandra did. And Paul Calandra just rubbed everyone's noses in the idea. And it was a sort of perfect little moment. You know, the question was serious. The question was straightforward. The answer was outrageous. And the answer was not just like outrageous and off topic, but it was about such a small, ridiculous little thing of this employee of the NDP who said some things on Facebook that were potentially offensive. You know, it all just sort of came together in a perfect little moment. And I don't know whether it just sort of confirmed everyone's beliefs about question period or made everyone realize how bad things were going. But, you know, thanks to Paul Calandra, we got to have a discussion about question period.
What makes it so different than the other non-answers that ministers give?
I think it was that it was just so far, you know, it was just so far off the playing field. You know, if Paul Calandra had stood up and said, the real issue here is that the NDP isn't supporting this mission in Iraq, it would have just been another Tuesday, and none of us would have talked about this. So it was just so far off. And I think Paul's right. Like, my first reaction to Tom Mulcair's response to the speaker was, that's not really, we don't really need that. That's not, we don't need people attacking the speaker on the floor of the House of Commons. If you disagree with the speaker, mount an argument about it. But because Mulcair was so forceful that this was so outrageous, it reinforced the fact that this was outrageous, that this was ridiculous. And whether or not, I mean, we can get into a longer discussion about whether or not the speaker should have the power to change what happened on Tuesday. Tom Mulcair drove home the point that this was ridiculous. And another thing on Tom Mulcair, now that I'm completely complimenting him, his first response to Paul Calandra by saying, close, we're in the Middle East and we're under the countries that begin with the letter I, but we're talking about Iraq, that was a pretty good witty response. And that gets replayed, and that again drove home how just completely insane the situation was.
And so, talking about the Mulcair interaction with the speaker, Paul, was he in the wrong there? Was he in the right to call out the speaker and question his neutrality in the House of Commons? And if he was right, I mean, does the speaker have to look at himself here and say, I need to make some changes to the way question period is run?
I get called a cynic around Ottawa for saying things like what I'm about to say, which is that I don't spend too much time worrying about right and wrong. I look at what works. And actually, at the moment when Mulcair said that, and some of my colleagues were on the Twitter saying, what a horrible thing, I said, well, he thinks the speaker's being unfair. Why would you not say the speaker's being unfair? And then on the ground of utility, it forced the speaker to explain his thinking in ways that were widely seen to be unsatisfactory. And it forced his interlocutor, Paul Calandra, to apologize. I expect, and actually, the government spent a whole week playing open and transparent after the Calandra answer. So even before Calandra had apologized, the government decided that it had better start behaving differently. That's a pretty good day at the office if you're Tom Mulcair.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at what the NDP's done now following this, maybe the Conservatives just underestimated this, is the NDP sets up this idea that the government's not being transparent here. Well, what does the government do 2 days later? Stephen Harper goes off to New York and says, oh, yeah, the U.S. has actually asked for some stuff. Oh, well, why didn't you say that here? That becomes question number one. Then question number two becomes, wait a second, there's this story that you actually went to the U.S. first, so why did you not mention that? And it just sort of starts lining up and compounding itself. And now on Monday, the NDP is going to move a motion in the House of Commons that says we need to change the rules so that you can't go way off topic on responses in the House of Commons. So we're going to have another day of debate about that. And then conceivably on Tuesday, Stephen Harper is going to show up in the House for question period, and Tom Mulcair is going to get another chance to go after him. Like, you know, you look at how this has gone, and as a pure political play, the NDP, I think, must be pretty happy with themselves.
Yeah, and I think as you guys were both alluding to, Thomas Mulcair got the headlines. He got the story over a full week rather than just giving in and making his one comment, a shot back at Calandra, and the story going away. So when we look at this moving forward, bringing up the NDP motion, what has to be done here to fix some of these problems that we're seeing in question period, or can anything be done?
I think public outrage is about the only thing that changes the way people behave. And there hasn't, frankly, been a lot of public outrage over these things that befix us here in Ottawa. I mean, so this was a week when it became clear that there is no immediate ceiling on Canadian involvement in a shooting war in Iraq. And the Prime Minister doubled down on a substantial and sometimes controversial investment in maternal and child health overseas. And we're all discussing Paul Calandra. I do think that Canadians have a hard time getting particularly riled when one person in Ottawa is mean to someone else in Ottawa.
All right, thank you very much. That is the Maclean's panel for this week. As always, joined by my co-host, Aaron Wherry, the associate editor for Maclean's magazine, and Paul Wells, the political editor for Maclean's, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, the Parliament Hill bureau chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Still to come on the show, we talk to a member of Parliament who has decided to leave politics after only one term. We hear from the soon-to-be Premier of New Brunswick, and we bring you Question Period in Review.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill bureau chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, associate editor for Maclean's magazine. Liberal MP Ted Hsu was elected for the first time in 2011, but after just 3 years representing Kingston and the Islands, he has decided he won't seek re-election in 2015. Hsu says the decision was essentially a personal one, made with the best interests of his daughters in mind. To discuss that decision and one rookie MP's observations on Parliament, I sat down with Ted Hsu this week in the Maclean's offices.
So Ted, first of all, obviously you've announced that you're not going to run for re-election. I guess can you walk us through that decision, sort of when you started thinking about it, how long it took you to kind of come to that decision?
Well, we were thinking about it over the summer, my wife and I, and it was not a political decision at all. It was a personal family decision, and when I started politics, in my nomination speech, the very first speech I gave, I talked about not wanting to pass on the burden of all the problems that we have onto our kids, that we should try to solve them today, and wanting to be fair to future generations. And so my main motivation for thinking hard about this problem is that in order to be true to that, I have to look at my own responsibilities as a father and my responsibilities to my own daughters. And so we looked really hard, and we just didn't find a way that would be right for the kids. And by the end of the summer, we decided that it was time to announce that I was not going to seek re-election.
Would you say you were surprised at all by sort of the complications of personal life and politics? I mean, I guess voters might not think about it too much.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I knew roughly what it would be like. And I knew that it would be, you know, we knew that it would be a strain on the family. And I think that different families are different. Different families have different priorities. But just for us, the way we like to raise children, the way we feel that it should be done, and our circumstances and resources, we tried to think out of the box. But in the end, we didn't feel we could do a second term.
You know, how difficult is it? Like, you know, a lot of MPs might even be jealous of you because you're not that far away from home. Mm-hmm. But obviously it's still a challenge to balance those.
I think the public may not know all the things that one has to juggle in work and life. And again, for me, it's connected to why I got into politics in the first place. And I always want to have a purpose for doing things. And it's not just to get elected and be the MP, but there are things that I want to work on. And I will continue to work on those same things after the next election.
Do we have to change things to some degree? Do we need to make adjustments to the way things work?
Well, there are a number of things. I mean, I think the basic idea is that you do have to be there for your constituents and spend the time to listen to them and do all the things you need to do. But I think there are some small things that we can do to make Parliament more efficient. I've mentioned in the past that Friday sittings are not a great use of time because there are no votes, there are no committee meetings, only one-third of the MPs are here. It's only a half day anyways. No other legislature in Canada sits on Fridays. We could take those 4 or 5 hours on Friday, move them to the other 4 days of the week, and give MPs a chance who travel back home, a chance to travel back home every Friday and work from home, work in their constituency offices, and go home for dinner on Friday night. I think that's one small thing. There are also, voting takes a long time. It takes 8 to 10 minutes to do this roll call vote where everybody stands up and their name is read out. That's a lot of time to do a vote, and I wonder whether there is some way to vote electronically. I don't know what that is, but it does take a lot of time for us to vote. And if you calculate, if you take the amount of money that it costs to run the House of Commons, it works out to be about $1,000 a minute. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of efficiency to be gained from saving even minutes.
Have you come away with any other sort of reflections on how things work up here in terms of, you know, the political life and how Parliament should run, beyond the idea of saving time on certain things? There's been this discussion in the air with Michael Chong's bill, with Brad Trost's proposal, to really start dealing with how things work up here. Have you come away with any sense of that?
Well, I think that there are also ways that we can make the time that we do spend up here more valuable and more meaningful. Debate is often repetitive, and some people repeat the party talking points and argue past each other in the House or in committee. And I really think that the public would be better served if there were more meeting of minds and a clash of ideas instead of people talking past each other. So I think debate could be improved. I think committees could be improved. Quite often the expectation is that not very much is going to happen in committee, and we're just there to put something on the record, put the party's position on the record. We tried to amend this bill in a certain way. This witness came in and said this in support of our position. So it's a matter of record rather than actually looking at bills and saying, this could be improved. Let's work together across party lines and try to improve it, or let's not because we can't agree.
That's rookie MP Ted Hsu, who has decided to leave politics after only one term.
On Monday, the people of New Brunswick went to the polls and chose a new government. Despite some technical hiccups with a new electronic voting system, the Liberals of Brian Gallant took power, ousting David Allward and his PCs. The Grits took 27 seats, while the Progressive Conservatives grabbed 21, and the Green Party leader won his riding to be the only third party in the legislature. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with the Premier-elect Brian Gallant about taking over his role at a young age and access to abortions, a controversial topic in New Brunswick.
Premier, I'm not sure how tired you are about questions about your age, but you're only 32, if I have that right, which makes you one of the few big league politicians in Canada who look at Justin Trudeau as kind of an old guy. What's your sense of how best to answer people who say that someone at your stage or even at his stage is too young, too inexperienced to have the top leadership roles in the country? It's been a sort of an undercurrent of debate here at the federal level for a while, I think likely to get bigger as the 2015 campaign rolls up. So to me, it's a relevant issue.
Well, where to begin? I think first off, New Brunswickers and Canadians as a whole don't judge people based on their gender, what language they speak, or how old they are. It's about their values, it's about their priorities, it's about how hard they'll work, and it's about their integrity. I'd like to think throughout the campaign, I showed people I'm willing to work extremely hard to better our province. I've showed people that my priority is job creation. I've showed people that what my values are, wanting to grow the economy so we can help families that are struggling in the province. So I think that resonates a lot stronger than anything that people see when they look at your vitals on how old you are, what your gender is, and what language you speak. So I can tell you that also that experience and age are not synonymous. I mean, I think I have many experiences that are going to help me do what I have to do here in the province. I come from a family where my parents worked at grocery stores and fast food restaurants their whole lives. We lived with my grandparents when they were ill in a small home, myself, my two siblings, and my parents. We went through some tough times, like many New Brunswick families and like many Canadians. And I saw firsthand what it's like to not know if you're necessarily going to get a paycheck the next week or how you're going to pay your bills. And I've seen my family, including my grandparents' budget, right to the last dollar. I believe those experiences that I got at a very young age are going to help me govern in a way that I fully understand what many New Brunswickers are going through. So I think it's a bit simplistic to say that because you may be a bit younger than someone else that you don't have experience that's going to help you be a leader and govern properly.
There's been a lot of interest in the early, very early days after the election out there in how you're going to handle the issue of access to abortion services in New Brunswick. Do you want to speak to that? What's your approach there?
Well, I believe here in New Brunswick, unfortunately, we're not respecting a woman's right to choose fully. We believe that there are barriers to that right here in New Brunswick, and we've made it very clear during the campaign that we would act swiftly to identify them and to eliminate them. For example, we believe that there's a two-doctor rule that exists in Regulation 8420 that is a barrier to a woman's right to choose, and that's something that we're going to address. It's obviously, as I'm sure you can recognize, it's obviously a very sensitive issue in New Brunswick and across the country, I'm sure. But when you want to be a leader, you have to take on things that are difficult, and you have to have conversations that aren't always easy. And as a premier, you can't cherry-pick which rights you feel like respecting. In fact, that's the whole point of having rights, is that sometimes when it is hard, that you can always count that they'll be there. So you can be sure that under a Liberal government here in New Brunswick, we're going to ensure that a woman's right to choose is respected.
That's McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Premier-elect of New Brunswick, Brian Gallant. To listen to the full interview, go to mcleans.ca.
And now it's time for our question period and review. We're joined by the host of QP Live on mcleans.ca, Nick Taylor-Vasey, who takes a look back at all the action this week on the floor of the House of Commons.
Parliamentary secretaries, the ministerial lieutenants who faithfully walk into the House of Commons and, in their boss's absence, recite the government's messages without missing a beat. The secretaries took center stage this week as Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Environment Minister Leona Igluka spent time away from Ottawa. Colin Carey is Igluka's parliamentary secretary, and as the world gathered for a climate summit, Carey fielded opposition questions in the Commons. He repeated again and again that the Tories have reduced greenhouse gas emissions considerably. Green leader Elizabeth May stood at the end of QP and politely disagreed.
Greenhouse gas levels have been rising steadily ever since the recession ended, and they are slated to end at 734 megatons by 2020, less than one half of 1% below 2005 levels when the Prime Minister committed to 17%. Can the Honourable Secretary commit that PMO will be instructed to check Environment Canada's website?
That drew some chuckles from nearby Liberals, but of course Carey begged to differ. To his credit, though, Carey at least talked about the environment when someone asked him about the environment. NDP leader Tom Mulcair had no such luck when he asked the Prime Minister's Parliamentary Secretary, Paul Calandra, about Canada's military commitments in Iraq.
Will the Conservative government confirm that the 30-day Canadian commitment in Iraq will indeed end on October 4th?
And how did Calandra respond?
There's a great deal of confusion with respect to the NDP position on Israel.
For his part, Mulcair quipped right back.
Well, I can understand the confusion. We are in the Middle East and we are under the eyes, but we're talking about Iraq.
And then Calandra yelled some more about Israel. His continuous non sequiturs, unchallenged by Speaker Andrew Scheer, actually prompted Mulcair to question Scheer's neutrality. The next day, the Speaker fired back, defending his conduct and warning the NDP leader that he was on thin ice. Mulcair then stood and repeated his questions about the mission in Iraq, including how many troops were on the ground. This time, James Bazan, the Parliamentary Secretary to Minister of Defence Rob Nicholson, responded.
I can confirm that we have committed 69 members of the Canadian Special Armed Forces to be in Iraq to provide tactical and strategic advice in a non-combat role.
On Thursday, Nicholson himself took his seat in the Commons. Mulcair asked the defense minister if Canadian troops were cleared to operate in Baghdad. Nicholson stood and, hey, what do you know, answered the question.
The 69 members of the Canadian Armed Forces have the full permission and cooperation of the Iraq government.
So, yes, things got a little restless in the House with the Prime Minister in New York City. But at least any toddlers who cared to watch learned that Israel and Iraq are both countries that start with I and that they're both in the Middle East. Baby steps.
Once again, with Question Period and Review, that's Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on mcleans.ca. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.